there's two handouts on seminars, one for Regis next Wednesday and one for Lonergan for the whole semester. There's the class notes, and there's a set of notes on a set of pages photocopied from Theology and the Dialectics of History. So you should have all of those for the class. The main things I'm concerned with are the class notes and the stuff from the Theology and the Dialectics of History. The notion of being, then, chapter 12 of Insight. What corresponds on the MP3 is the material August 9th, lecture 2. The MP3, it's the second of the MP3s, and it's the August 9th, lecture 2, is the material that corresponds to this. Yes?
And what part of understanding of being does it correspond to?
Chapter 7. Believe it's 7. Has anybody got understanding of being here? I think it's either 6 or 7. You know how you can tell is look at the bottom of at the beginning of the chapter, it tells you the day. And it would be August 9th, but the second part of whatever that is, it's either 6 or 7. Chapter 6 or 7, chapter 7. Okay, so chapter 12 of Insight, the notion of being, is this. Yes, Chris?
What was that CD, again, August 9th?
Lecture 2. The MP3 for August 9th, lecture 2. Chapter 12, then, is the second of the pivotal chapters in the book. When we get to chapter 14, you'll see something at the very beginning where he'll talk about three basic positions. Position on knowing. All right, that's chapter 11. Position on the real. So he's setting that up in chapter 12. He doesn't really yet get to the real. He gets to being. The being is not yet identified with the real. And then a position on objectivity, which is chapter 13. So these are the pivotal chapters in the book. These are the three basic positions of the philosophy, at least as it was in his possession at the time that he wrote Insight. I think he went on to a couple of further basic positions with regard to the good and with regard to transcendence that are, in this book, a more extensions of these basic positions. I think later on they might be listed as 4 and 5. But for this book, at least, these are the three basic positions. Knowing, being, knowing the real, and objectivity. And the chapter on being sets up the discussion of the real. So this chapter then treats being and the notion of being. While it can be argued, this is my own interpretation, but I think others would agree with it, that the position put forward here is in harmony with the position of Aquinas. I think it can and must be claimed that, as it's stated here, it is an original position with Lonergan. And one of the reasons that I'm saying that is that he didn't have this position when he wrote the Verbum Articles between 1946 and 1949. It is not in there. When he's studying knowing and inner word and Aquinas, he is not yet at the point of being able to talk about the notion of being in this way. He arrived at it, I think, sometime between 1949, when he started writing Insight, and 1953, when, for all practical purposes, he finished the book. So it's something that he arrived at at that period. All right, so what is being, then? Being is defined as the objective of the pure desire to know. It's the objective of the process that leads, by questions, from experience to understanding, from understanding to judgment. It's the objective. It's what we're after when we raise and answer questions for intelligence and questions for reflection. Questions for intelligence, what is this and is that? So the answer to that second question gives you being. It gives you what is. So it's the notion of being, heading towards being, and being then is the objective of that desire to know. The objective of the pure desire to know. And so that makes the pure desire itself be the intelligent and reasonable notion of being, the desire in us that makes us raise questions is an anticipation of where we will get when we answer those questions. And that anticipation is what Lonergan means by the word notion. So notion, he has a very specific and technical meaning for the term notion. He does not mean concept. He does not mean idea. He means anticipation, but intelligent and reasonable anticipation. So when you feel hunger in your stomach, you have an anticipation of food, but it's not a notion of food. Okay. It's just you're hungry. But when you raise and answer questions, you have a notion of being. A notion used in that sense. Not a concept. It is not an idea. It's an anticipation. It's a movement towards. It's knowing that you want to get somewhere. And that somewhere that you want to get to may be very indeterminate, but you know you want to get somewhere, and that's the notion. Right? And what the objective of that at the end of it is what will be called being. So we want being. We want, if you want, a marriage of our spirit with what is. And we achieve that as we raise and answer these questions and judge truly. This is the case. So the dynamic orientation manifested in our questions for intelligence and for reflection, the prior and enveloping drive that carries cognitional process from sense and imagination to the complete, from sense and imagination to understanding, from understanding to judgment, and from judgment to the complete context of correct judgments, that is the notion of being. That arrow, okay, what's represented by that arrow. It's described precisely as a pure desire to know on 372, 373, and you don't need to look at this, I'll just read it to you. The desire to know is simply the inquiring and critical spirit of the human being. So this is about 8 pages up if you do have the book. By moving one to seek understanding, it prevents one from being content with the mere flow of outer and inner experience. So it moves me on from experience to understanding. By demanding adequate understanding, so not just any understanding, but adequate understanding, it involves one in the self-correcting process of learning, in which further questions yield complementary insights. By moving us to reflect, to seek the unconditioned, to grant unqualified assent only to the unconditioned, it prevents one from being content with hearsay and legend, with unverified hypotheses and untested theories. Finally, by raising still further questions for intelligence and reflection, it excludes complacent inertia. For if the questions go unanswered, we cannot be complacent. We won't stop asking the questions until we find the answers. And if answers are sought, we are not inert. So what we're after when we raise and answer these questions, there's a further type of question of what am I to do? And that's the question for the good. But these questions are questions for the real. What is it? Okay. So this desire then has an objective, and that objective is treated beginning on 373, and we'll take that in the next numbers here. The pure desire is identified precisely as notion of being in section 3, beginning on page 377. I wanted to I hope I brought this stuff with me, and I brought one thing with me that I wanted to do. I think I've got them both here. Yeah, I've got them both. In a supplement that Lonergan wrote to his Christology book, Supplement on Redemption, the first chapter is on good and evil. And in that first chapter, he says the following. This is Mike Shields' translation of this. It was written in Latin for the classes of the Brit. If you look for the deeper roots of human activity, you will find four desires implanted in us by nature. First, the natural desire to understand. That's what we need to understand. Which will not be satisfied, now he's talking here in a theological context, until it knows God through God's essence. Secondly, the natural desire for rectitude, for justice, at this decision level, and the moral necessity of the will to carry out whatever reason commands. Thirdly, the natural desire for happiness, which, however indeterminate in itself, receives its determination principally from our higher nature. So we will be happy when we find the truth and the good, the intelligible, the true and the good. That's what gives us happiness. And fourthly, the natural desire for immortality, so that not only in this life, but in a never-ending future life, we might know, praise, and worship a supreme deity as the source and goal of all things. Besides these desires of the human spirit, we can note our remarkable elevation of feeling and our polymorphous sensibility, which reveal us to be more an incarnate spirit than an animal having the use of reason. So as he went along, he preferred the notion of incarnate spirit to rational animal as a definition of the human being, the incarnate spirit. So that's one way of situating this desire to know within a broader context, which heads towards being, which heads also towards the good and towards God. And another way in which he came to express it is in a late paper called Natural Right and Historical Mindedness in a third collection. So I'm just trying to locate this in terms of a broader context before we talk about it in its in the framework which you find in Insight.
What page are you on now?
In the third collection, 174, 175. There is a deeper and more comprehensive principle that is at once a principle of movement and of rest, a tidal movement that begins before consciousness, down here, nerves, nervous system, dreams, nervous system coming into consciousness and dreams and symbols and so on, a tidal movement that begins before consciousness and unfolds through sensitivity, intelligence, rational reflection, responsible decision, only to find its rest beyond all of these. And the point beyond where it finds its rest is being love, a dynamic state that sublates, lifts it all up, all that goes before. Being in love is a principle of movement that is at once purgative and illuminative, and a principle of rest in which union is fulfilled. So this fits then within a much broader theological context. But right now what we're concerned with is this framework here, from experience to understanding, and understanding to judgment, as the desire to know heading towards its objective being. Being is what is, and that's what we desire to know. We want to know what is. Now, we don't want to know just anything. We want to know what is. So number three then, the objective of the pure desire is the content of knowing rather than the satisfaction of performing the act. Obviously, when you have a brilliant insight, you can be very satisfied, you know, and it's great, it's fun, it's happy, you feel good. But we want more than that, because we don't want brilliant insights that are wrong. Okay, and there are a lot of those. But we want the content of knowing. We're after, that's why we don't stop here. Even no matter how brilliant something might be, we've got to test it. And it's only the testing that will satisfy us, when it fulfills the test. What is it that the pure desire to know henceforth anticipates wants to know? The answer to that question is being. That objective at any time includes all that's already known and all that remains to be known. And then the quote from the book itself. Initially in each individual, when we're born, the pure desire is a dynamic orientation to a totally unknown. We don't know anything. As knowledge develops, that objective becomes less and less unknown, more and more known. Or again, being is, number one, all that is known, and two, all that remains to be known. The whole universe, being. Again, since a complete increment of knowing occurs only in judgment, being is what is to be known by the totality of true judgments, by all the true judgments that could be made. What is that totality? It's the complete set of answers to the complete set of questions. What the answers are remain to be seen. What the questions are awaits their emergence. Meaningless or incoherent or illegitimate questions may be possible, but how they are to be defined is a further question. The affirmation in hand is just this, that there exists a pure desire to know, an inquiring and critical spirit that follows up questions with further questions, that heads for some objective which has been named being. And we can add here, and it isn't satisfied until it knows that it has gotten there. And then on any given issue, when it knows that it has gotten there, it stops on that issue. It doesn't repeat the process. There are some things that are in secure possession in all of you, in all of us. There are some things that are knowing, cognition-wise, we're securely in hold in our hands, in our minds. Okay? And we don't go back and repeat those things, but we go on to further things. All right? Okay. So next, what kind of definition is this? It's not like it's different from a lot of other definitions. When you say the human being is an incarnate spirit, you're defining what really is appropriate to what is human. It's a spirit in a body, an enfleshed spirit. But this is a different kind of definition. And I'll give the answer here first from insight, and then from understanding and being. And you'll hear this on the MP3, the second one. And I'll complement the latter, the material from understanding and being, with further material from insight. So insight, he says, the definition is of the second order. Other definitions, for instance, a human person is an incarnate spirit. They determine what is meant. That's what I mean by a human person. If it's not incarnate, it's not a human person. If it's not a spirit, it's not a human person. An incarnate spirit, that sums up what you mean by a human being. And it covers just about everything. It doesn't give you all the details, but it gives you the basis to work towards all the details about a human. But this definition, being is the objective of the pure desire to know, is more remote. For it assigns not what is meant by being, but how you will determine that meaning in any given case, how you'll get there. And that's what he means by saying it's a definition of the second order. There's another way in which he puts this over and over again later in the book. Being is whatever is to be known by intelligent grasp and reasonable reflection. Intelligent grasp, coming to referring to the level of understanding, reasonable reflection, referring to the level of the critical reflection, sometimes critical reflection. Another term that he uses here. Whatever is to be known by intelligent grasp and critical reflection. Okay. And then he'll divide that into proportion of being and transcendent being. Proportionate being is what also comes within the ken of our experience, data. Transcendent being, if transcendent being comes within the ken of our experience, it's only because transcendent being gives itself to us to be experienced. But otherwise, it's not a datum in this world. God can give God's self to us in grace and in love and in so on. And that, in that sense, there's a way in which God comes into experience, but only as a result of gift. But otherwise, it's not within the horizon of our experience. So he will later distinguish between proportionate and transcendent, but for both of them, it's intelligent grasp and critical reflection, reasonable reflection. So this definition asserts, I mean, page 2 in this, if you know being. If you wish to know, you wish to know being. But it doesn't settle whether you know. You only know that if you make a true judgment and know that you've made a true judgment. And it doesn't settle what you know, whether your wish will be fulfilled or what you will know when it is fulfilled. It just tells you if you want to know, what you want to know is what is. You're heading towards it. Understanding and being, and this is on the August 9th MP3, the very beginning of lecture 2, to put the question, knowing what, is to ask about the object of knowledge in a linguistic or grammatical sense. And that's the sense in which he's defining being here, as the object of the transitive verb to know. The question of objectivity has not arisen yet. It's with the question of objectivity that being will become identified as the real, that this objective will be named the real. It's in the next chapter that it's named the real. At this point, we're just using a word for it, being. What is? And he does identify it with what is. But there are a number of people, for instance, who will have said that being is simply not nothing, a very empty concept, or that being is what is perceived. An idealist, or what being is what is thought. Okay. The idealist positions. This is the Scotist conceptualist position, where being is not nothing. So there are other notions of being than the one that he's saying here. He's saying, no, being is what is, and in the next chapter on objectivity, what is what is real, the real. Okay. So he's not there yet. He's not quite there yet. The question of objectivity has not arisen yet. Is the knowing objective? Is being the real? As far as this chapter is concerned, the being that is the objective, in that other sense of objective, the objective, what you're after, of the desire to know, might be the real, but it might be the ideal. Or it might be something more empty, like the Scotist definition. Being is just not nothing. If it's being, well, that means it's not nothing, big deal. For Lonergan, being's a big deal. It is. Because it's everything about everything, rather than not nothing. Real difference there. Well, the spirit is different. So the chapter on objectivity is what leads on to the further question. Again, in 373, 374, what is this objective? Is it limited or unlimited? Is it one or many? Is it material or ideal? Is it phenomenal or real? Is it an immanent content, perceived thought, or a transcendent object, transcendent, self-transcendent? Is it, that's a mistake there, is it a realm of experience or of thought or of essences or of existence? It could be any of those. Up to this point. Answers to these and any other questions have but a single source, namely the pure desire to know. Okay. That's what will answer those questions when you get to. They cannot be had without the functioning of the pure desire. Excuse me. They cannot be had from the pure desire to know alone. They are to be had in as much as the pure desire initiates and sustains the cognitional process. So, if it is true that I am, you are, and I am not you, then being is many. It's not one. It's at least two. Right. If those are three true judgments, I am, you are, I am not you, then if each one of those judgments is true, then being is at least two. Right. It's not one. It's many. It's plural. But if it's true that I am and everything else is a function of me, then being is ultimately one. If it's true that A is and A is one and there is only A, then the objective of the pure desire to know is one. If it's true that A is, that B is, that A is not B, then the objective is many. Which, you ask, is true. The fact that you ask results from the pure desire. But to reach the answer, desiring is not enough. You've got to go through inquiring and reflecting on this. Whatever you end up with at the end of that, that will give you your answer. So when you reach the true answer, you will have added an increment in your knowing. Okay, are we okay up to this point? Coral.
What's the error, Bob, that you said in that paragraph halfway down?
When I said that you have it, you get the answer from the pure desire, and I read him saying it, it's not. Oh, you mean that the.
It was a little, I think it had to do with the typo error,
halfway down, rather than it is a realm of experience, it should be is it a realm of experience? It's a question.
Oh.
thought you meant the mistake that I made when I said that what gives it to you is the pure desire. Well, it's not just the pure desire. It's the pure desire carrying you through the operations of experience and judgment. Are you with it? Is this
these other options, they're concepts of being or notions, they're not notions of being in
there, well, there would be others who will say that this is what being is. Okay, so being is, they wouldn't define it in terms of the desire to know. For instance, there are many positions of other forms of realism besides Lonergan's realism that are very afraid to start with knowing. Because if you define being in terms of knowing, they're afraid of idealism. One of the most wonderful teachers that I had, Linus Throw, who died just at age 90 just a couple of years ago in St. Louis. But to the day of his death, as far as I know, from Karl Starkloff, Linus was convinced that Lonergan was captured. Because he started with knowing. And you got to start with being. And understanding and being, Lonergan says, it doesn't make any difference where you start as long as you complete the loop. And as long as you show that knowing and being are isomorphic with one another. But and he finds it critically more persuasive to start with the full phenomenology of the knowing process and then to say that being is the objective of that, and to name being that way. And if the objective is the objective of true judgment, well, true judgment is not just a thought. True judgment says what is, independently of my thinking. So it's not idealism, it's not kinship. Okay? So, but there are others, esse est percipi, to be, this is Barclay, British empiricist, to be is to be perceived. Okay. Well, that's this, being is what is perceived. So it's an immanent content rather than what is, whether it's perceived or not.
When he says what is, if a conceptualization, what I don't quite understand is how you square what is with what can be, with what is created. Because if a conceptualization has never been, then it wasn't until somebody thought of it.
Yeah.
So anything that anyone could possibly think of is what he would that would be true, would be something that is, even though nobody knew about it before.
You mean something that we think of and then create?
Something we create. Well, it could be a physical sense. I mean, before there was ever a wheel, there were no wheels. Now there are wheels all over the place.
Sure, and what he will say later on that we are engaged in the making of being.
Okay.
So now wheels are, and it is true to say wheels are, but there certainly was a time when wheels weren't, and nobody even would have known what you were talking about. So it would not have been a true judgment at that point to say wheels are.
So it depends.
In God's mind, it would have been a true judgment to say wheels are, but that's the eternal mind, you know, where everything is pure now. And so, but from our standpoint,
it's temporal.
What
is temporal?
But we are engaged with God in the making of being.
Good. That's what I hope. Yes.
In method, you'll talk about is it realms of being, or
yes,
like mathematical,
yes,
being.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there are the moon and the logarithm of the square root of minus one, right? Well, they both are, but the only way that you can use the word is of both of them is if you have this kind of notion of being, because as Lonergan says, the moon is not a mathematical formula. And the logarithm of the square root of minus one is not a sphere floating around in the heavens. But both are, because both can be reasonably affirmed on the basis of experience, understanding, and judgment. And you come to, it is. So, and if it is, it's something to do with being. The logarithm of the square root of minus one, if that judgment is true, and that is, then that's something about the intelligibility of being. Is. And being is this way. It's not, it's much more than that. That's just one true judgment, but that's part of it. And if you denied it, you would be missing out on some little facet of being. But there are spheres of being, and the moon, he uses the mathematical and the moon as examples of different spheres of being.
Spheres is the word.
It's the analogy, okay? It's an this is the way in which being is analogous. In this chapter, he will, when he gets to the issue of analogy, you can speak of the analogy of being in the sense that is means so many different kinds of things that are, okay? But if they all are, if is goes truly with each of them, then you have different spheres of being. And spheres, of course, is their metaphor.
So why is this not a linguistic trick?
Well, so far it can be a linguistic trick up to this point. It's the next chapter that he will maintain gets it beyond the linguistic trick. And that's why I thought it was important with the understanding to give you the understanding of being admission. But this is a linguistic. This is a linguistic sense of word being. It's as the object of the transitive verb to know. The next chapter on objectivity.
Just a curiosity. This question that he raises here, whether the end is one or more than one,
yeah.
Is that something that he will also pursue in the next chapter?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's the heart at the heart of the pattern of objectivity. It's that pattern of judgments. So it would be featured predominantly. Okay, number three, we can do some more here. Okay, but then, number six, the definition does determine at least some characteristics of being. Okay. Let me go one more step here to give you just a sense of how this is an open notion. This notion heads toward everything about everything. The completely concrete. Because we, in principle at least, can never cease asking questions until we know everything about everything. That is being. That's the notion of being is the heading towards everything about everything. The idea of being is knowing everything about everything. The idea of being is God. Ipsum intelligere. The subsistent act of understanding, knowing everything about everything. Only God, the idea of being. So, and again, how the notion is not an idea. We want to know, we, in principle at least, want to know, can ask about whatever arises for us to raise questions about. And so, in principle at least, it's true to say we wouldn't mind knowing everything about it. That's the notion. But the idea is knowledge. Okay, so this definition does determine at least some characteristics of being. If being is what is to be known by the totality of true judgments, then being is all-inclusive. Because beyond the totality, beyond what is known by the totality of true judgments, there can't be anything else. If there is, then there'd be another true judgment. So it's all inclusive. Apart from being, there is nothing. Apart from what is to be known by the totality of true judgment, there is nothing else. Because if there were, then there would be another true judgment required to know. Again, it's completely concrete and completely universal. It's completely concrete. Over and above the being of anything, there's nothing more of that thing. So over and above the being of each one of you, there's nothing more to you. Okay? Your being is everything about you. Everything about you. Every true judgment that can be made about you, that's your being. And there's nothing more of you. and it's completely universal, apart from the realm of being, there is simply nothing. But that's so different from this empty thing of not nothing. Everything about everything, rather than just not nothing. Okay? Everything about everything. And then some objections that may be brought against the claim that being is all-inclusive. These objections, he maintains, are self-defeating. So, at the root of all that can be affirmed, at the root of all that can be conceived, is the pure desire to know. And it is that pure desire underlying all judgment and formulation, underlying all questioning and all desire to question, that defines its all-inclusive objective. So it sets you up with that, and then he gives you some of these objections. Well, there's an awful lot that we don't know. Of course, that's not what he's claiming. We know that fact by raising questions that we do not answer. Being is defined not only by the answers we give, that's just the small fraction of being that we know, but also by the questions that we ask. In chapter 17, this will become the distinction between the known and the known unknown. The known is what I have secure possession of through the true judgments that I've made in the course of my life. The known unknown is what I ask about. It's known because I know enough about it to ask about it, but it's unknown, and that's the reason that I'm asking about it. So there's the known, and there's the known unknown. And then there's also the unknown unknown, which is what is beyond my horizon, and I'm not yet ready to ask about. Horizon is defined as the boundary between the known unknown and the unknown unknown. Anyone's horizon at any given time is that boundary line. Everything that you can ask about is within your horizon. But what is beyond your horizon, you can't even ask about. That doesn't mean that it isn't, okay? And it can still be something that can come into your horizon, and the questions can arise later on in your life, and so on and so forth. Anyway, that's another way of talking about the same thing. The known unknown, and the unknown unknown. And of course, as I think I mentioned, did I mention it here or in the other class? I think Donald Rumsfeld actually used this language about Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction. And I said, oh no. But you know, somebody said, what are you going to do about it? You can't find these things. And he said, well, there's some things we know, and some things we know we don't know, and there's some things we don't know we don't know. Not Donald Rumsfeld. Anyway. Secondly, there's much that it would be futile for us to try to learn. Of course that's the case. I mean, if I started right now to try to learn something like this, that I didn't have the sufficient preparation for, it would be futile. But in response to that objection, being is defined not only by the questions we can hope to answer, but also by the questions whose answer we have to postpone. By all, what is to be known in response to all, all possible questions. Thirdly, some may say they have no desire to know everything about everything. Who wants to know everything about everything? Well, in response, they know that they don't already know everything about everything because so many questions remain unanswered. And being is defined merely by those, partly by those questions. That's all he's saying. Or from the opposite side, one might claim that the definition is too inclusive because there are mistaken questions that lead nowhere. And his response to that is, being is defined not as the objective of these formulated questions, but as the objective of the pure desire to know, which is prior to any formulated question and is not itself a formulation. Your desire to know, whose objective is being, is the source not only of answers, but also of their criteria. Remember all that stuff about the virtually unconditioned, huh? The sufficient evidence. We know when we've got sufficient evidence for a judgment. And not only of questions, but also of the grounds on which they're screened. Because it is intelligent inquiry and critical reflection that just as much yield the right questions as the right answers. Fifthly, is being really what is to be known through the totality of true judgments? Might it not be something entirely different? Well, if these questions are valid, they put the misgivings to rest. For the being that might be totally different turns out to be exactly what we're talking about. Because if we ask whether it might be, we ask. The being we're talking about is whatever we ask about. And sixthly, might there not be something beyond the range of the pure desire? Now, this is a big question, okay? Might there not be something? Well, the very fact that you ask that question means that it, whatever it is, that it's within your range. The X, whatever it is within your range. Because being is the objective of the questions, not of your answers. It's the anything and everything that is the objective of the desire. So within the potential range of the human spirit is everything about everything. This is one of the points to come away with from the claims that he's making in this chapter. That everything about everything. This is the way of his saying that what Thomas said when he said that the human spirit is potens omnia fear, able to become all things through knowing, through questioning and knowing. That there's nothing that is beyond the range of the human spirit. We are kapax dei. We are capable of God. We are, our spirit is that all-embracing. Okay? God is unrestricted understanding, over here, unrestricted understanding, knowing everything and not everything. We are unrestricted desire. Unrestricted understanding, unrestricted desire. Unrestricted desire for the same thing that God is. Restricted understanding. And that's why we will never be satisfied until we know God by God's essence. We are the pure desire to know will not be satisfied. Because we are unrestricted desire for the unrestricted understanding that God is. And so we will not rest. Augustine, our heart is made for you. Aquinas, our mind is made for you. And we will not rest until we find you. Let's do number 8. The desire to know, then, is a spontaneously operative notion of being. The notion of being is invariant. It's common to all people. Everybody raises questions, and when they raise questions, they want to know what is. And it functions in the same way no matter what theoretical account of it one may accept. We have to distinguish between the spontaneously operative notion and theoretical accounts of its genesis and content. The latter, the theoretical accounts, will vary with philosophical contexts. Some of these are here on the board. And so on. Now, what Lonergan's doing in this chapter, he's giving you his own theoretical account and identifying the notion with the desire. And he gives the reasons on 377, 378, and I'm quoting that right here. This will take us over onto the next page. First of all, we are apt to agree that things are, whether or not we know them. So let's start with that. And moreover, that there are many things that are known only incompletely or even not at all. So the notion of being then extends beyond the known, because we know that there are things that we don't know. And we know that because we ask questions. Secondly, being is known in judgment. When you say this is true. It is in judgment that we affirm or deny. And until we're ready to affirm or deny, we do not yet know whether or not any X happens to be. Still, though being is known only in judging, the notion of being is prior to judging, because it's what brings us there. Prior to any judgment, there's reflection. And reflection is formulated in the question, is it? Is it? Okay? That's a notion of being. Is it? That question supposes some notion of being, and strangely enough, it's prior to each instance of our knowing. See it in child. What is it? Is. Thirdly, there are objects of thought. In one sense, they're all equivalent. For as long as one is merely thinking, merely considering, merely supposing, one deals merely with the conditioned, and it makes no difference whether or not its conditions are fulfilled. And you can do that. And then sometimes it's healthy to do it. Just to think about things. Thinking then prescinds from existing. But if it prescinds from existing, does it not prescind from being? And if it prescinds from being, is not all thinking about nothing? The trouble with this argument is that thinking also prescinds from non-existing. But in another sense, thinking does not prescind from existing and not existing, for thinking most of the time is purposive. We think to get our concepts straight. We wish to get our concepts straight that we may be able to judge. So far from prescinding from existing or not existing, thinking is for the purpose of determining whether or not what is thought does exist. And then the next page, it follows that the notion of being goes beyond the merely thought. So we ask whether or not the merely thought exists. No less it follows that the notion of being is prior to thinking. For were it not, then thinking could not be for the purpose of judging, which it is most of the time, not always, for the purpose of determining whether or not the merely thought exists. The notion of being, then, is prior to conception and goes beyond it. It is prior to judgment and goes beyond it, because it raises, you get to one judgment, then you raise further questions, leading you to other ones. That notion must be the immanent, dynamic orientation of cognitional process. It must be the detached and unrestricted desire to know as operative in cognitional process. Desiring to know is desiring to know being, but it is merely the desire and not yet the knowing. Thinking is thinking being. It's not thinking nothing, but thinking being is not yet knowing. Judging is a complete increment in knowing. If correct, it is a knowing of being, but it is not yet knowing being. That is to say, the idea of being, knowing everything about everything, it's just knowing this about this. But that is attained only through the totality of true judgment. Knowing being, knowing everything about everything, you'd have to be able to make the totality of true judgment. So I don't know everything about everything, but I know this about this. So that is a knowing of being, but not knowing being, which is everything. So this makes sense. Knowing of being is X is Y. That's a very minute increment. Questions, and then we'll take a break. Yes, Chris.
You said that the idea of being is a totality of correct judgments is God.
The idea of being is the knowing of everything, knowing everything about everything. God is, it would not be put so much in terms of the totality of true judgments, because in God is one act of understanding that grasps everything in its relationship to everything else.
Right. So
it's not a bunch of judgments in God.
Sure. So then my question is that, so if God is the infinite act of understanding that grants being as a totality of correct judgments, I'm wondering, what's the distinction between the being of God as the infinite act of understanding that is identical with God's essence, and the content of the infinite act of understanding?
There is no difference.
Everything about everything.
There is no difference.
So there's no difference between the transcendent being and proportionate being?
No. The content between the infinite act of understanding and the content of the infinite act of understanding, is that what you're asking?
That's right.
Yeah, that they're the same, because knowing and known are identical anyway. All right.
Oh yeah.
And so God is the infinite act of understanding that knows everything about everything. Oh, is God the everything about everything? Is that what you mean?
That's what
is God everything about everything? No.
Yeah.
No. Okay, I didn't get the brunt of your question. No. But everything that is a participation in the being of God. We're getting into chapter 19 now, because of God's creative activity. It would not be without the actus totius entis, the act of all of being. Okay. So, okay, I see what I
my
see.
My question is just the being of God is the infinite act of understanding that's identical to God's essence,
yeah.
That God's being, and the content that is what is grasped by the infinite act.
All right, the content is distinguished, we're jumping seven chapters ahead now. It's distinguished into the primary intelligible and the idea of being and the secondary intelligible. The primary intelligible is the infinite act of understanding itself. So what God first knows is God.
Mm.
All right. And in God, God knows everything else, the secondary intelligence. So, and those are the divine ideas, or whatever you want to call them. Okay. And it's what everything else that is and everything else that could be.
So that then our intellects are proportionate to that being.
To the
secondary intelligible.
Yeah. The secondary, well, and to what actually is, because the secondary intelligibles also include all possible worlds.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that. We're proportionate to what can come within the ken of our experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, we're proportionate to the universe that is,
yeah.
But not necessarily to all possible universes, because, you know, how would we get the data if they don't, if they aren't?
Yeah.
So. Yes.
If God is not everything about everything, if it is possible to know God without knowing everything about everything, then it is possible to not care, whatever objection for there, that you might not want to know everything. If you know God, you know enough. You don't need to know everything about everything.
But if you do know God by God's essence, then you have a knowledge of everything that God knows. The beatific vision is a share, created participation in the infinite knowledge of God. You don't know it till you know God by God's essence. You know. And how do we move towards it? Lonergan was asked this in the Understanding of Beatitude. When we get to God, do we have a series of insights and a series of judgments and say, I don't know and I'm not going to know till I get there. How? But if the beatific vision is knowing God by God's essence, then it is somehow. Karl Rahner maintains that the virtue of hope does not stop when we die. And hope is the ever greater moving. It's what propels us when we're seeing God to move ever further into God. Lonergan says that in chapter 19, God is the ultimate limit of the process of going beyond, which is what he means by transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't go beyond God, but you can go ever more into God.
That's like asymptotically, you grow into it, and you can never get there.
That's
Mr. Fry poetically has a poem which he ends with, and I wish I had, was trying to find it the other day because I know I quoted it in a paper that I wrote long, many years ago. Exploration into God.
Does Rahner also say that mystery never ceases being mystery,
right.
even
in the beatific
vision? In the beatific vision.
Yeah. And I think that corresponds with Rahner. On all of that stuff, Rahner and Lonergan are just using different words for saying the same thing. There are many cases that are the same. The cognitional theory is not the same, but their theology, their notion of God is the same. Lonergan's Trinitarian theology is much more complete than Rahner's. Yes, Jeff?
Well, I've become alive, we cannot know God's essence, but we at least wish to know God's essence. Is intending God's essence an example of the unknown known or the known unknown?
The known unknown. Well, I mean, once you know that God is, at least it's the known unknown. But even, in a sense, it's even the anticipated, and in that sense, known unknown, because you got a hunch of it. The very fact, mystery is a permanent feature of human experience. That opens you on to the divine. But he'll say when he discusses mystery in chapter 17 that there have been, you know, many different ideas of mystery. And divine revelation is really a way of letting us know something about the mystery. We could be lost if we all caught up in those sorts of myths. Yes.
I have just a question about the unknown unknown.
Yeah.
Is it possible to just to mention unknown unknown, because as soon as we mention about unknown unknown, it is there. So
yeah,
we
and
know,
that's,
we
in that
know.
Sense, in that sense, it's within the range, you see. But it's still the unknown unknown, because all we know about it is that there have to be things that I can't even ask questions about. I don't even have enough clues to ask questions about. But we probably, that's probably true. And in that sense, it is an unknown unknown. But even that brings it slightly within the known unknown, because you can say that much about it. Kathy's categories are
loose. Just very quickly to say that last evening on Ideas, a CBC 9 o'clock program, Professor Ursula Franklin from emeritus, I think now, physicist from U of T, and in a lecture, her whole plea was to attend to the question and the value of the question, and she situated in data from her own experience with alloys of copper and major companies, and just moved through in an extraordinary way. And I thought, oh, you know, I don't believe she has an acquaintance at this point with honoring, but it's extraordinary the way she was making this presentation to people in the academy and graduate students.
Well, Maria Montessori, too, was her, the whole Montessori method in education was the most important thing, are the questions of the students.
Right.
Don't shut the door. That's the way they learn. Right. Otherwise, you're just dumping concepts on them.
Right.
They don't have any insights, but they'll get insights if you let them raise their own questions. Not good with that. That's the way to teach.
You can get a little bored.
Okay, let's break for 10 minutes.